Thank you, Your Honor. For the record, Forrest Lewis on behalf of Mr. LaRosa. When I first looked at this case, the concept of corpus delicti seemed obvious enough to me. But as I read through it, I came to the conclusion that I really didn't understand it, and it was more difficult to apply than I thought it should have been or than I thought it was. I sort of approached it from a trial lawyer's perspective, and any time we have a statement by anyone in a trial, confession or prior consistent statement or otherwise, we look at it and we sort of try to confirm things which are internally present within the statement as being true. And so we convince someone that the statement is true and viable by taking parts of it and proving them with external evidence. I don't think that's the rule with corpus delicti as I read the cases. I think that the general rule is established in Rankin, in cases like Rankin, as Justice Erickson wrote back in 76, that the law really does require independent proof, independent of the confession, of a corpus delicti, before there can be a prima facie case which can go to a jury. I think that's the general rule. I believe that where I got confused was in what I call the Martinez-Trujillo exception. And the Martinez-Trujillo exception is that in crimes which are incohate crimes, like conspiracy, which Martinez and Trujillo were, you don't really expect a dead body, that you look to the confession itself, and the goal is to try to determine whether the confession internally can be corroborated. Now, the facts in both of those cases are rather extreme, and it's rather obvious. But I think what helped me try to understand was Judge Briggs' opinion in Trujillo, where he talks about the difference, the exception to the general rule. In cases like conspiracies, Trujillo, I think, was a conspiracy to commit robbery, like Trujillo, where there isn't this tangible corpus delicti to a conspiracy, that we're looking for evidence that corroborates the confession. But that's not the general rule in a case like LaRosa. The law doesn't implore us to seek evidence that corroborates the confession. There's a difference. Conceptually, it implores us and requires us to seek independent evidence that shows that a crime was committed, independent of the confession. And that's what was missing from this case. And as I said in the reply brief, my confession in the reply brief was that I spent too much time arguing about whether or not the confession in this case was the product of a mental illness. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It isn't the issue of the confession and whether it can be corroborated. I'm sure, for example, that in Robson, I'm sure that Mr. Robson could have described the interior of his home to the T, where he was alone with his daughter. I'm sure he could have described every room and talked about sometimes when he was alone with her. And so you could take internal parts of Robson's confession, and you could corroborate them with independent evidence. That's not the issue. The issue is whether there's independent evidence that a crime has really been committed versus imagined. And so I think I got a little off track. I confessed to the court in my reply brief that I had probably spent too much time trying to attack the confession. That's the trial lawyer in me, I think. But as I read more and as I discussed in the reply brief, the real issue is, as Justice Erickson said in Rankin, whether there's truly evidence independent of, apart from the confession, that a crime had been committed. So what we have in this case is, let's say Quinn, for example. Let's draw an analogy with Quinn, because that seemed to be a pivotal case for the trial court. And we both talked about it, and you have to be considering it. So if we take Quinn, for example, I'm sure in Quinn, she could have described describes the interior of the jail where she went to visit her boyfriend. I go in, there's a counter, I register, you go back, here's what the cells look like. She could have described it much as Mr. LaRosa described the rec center or the shower areas or the dressing room, but that wouldn't have been independent evidence. The independent evidence in Quinn, which had nothing to do with her confession, was a letter written by the inmate. One of the pieces of independent evidence, a powerful piece, I think, was a letter written by the inmate. Another powerful piece of evidence in Quinn, which had nothing to do with her confession, was the fact that she put money on this box. Totally independent. It has nothing to do with her confession. And the fact that there was independent evidence that she had a relationship with him and that she cared about him. The liquor store that she described sells the kind of liquor. So if you look at what happened in LaRosa at trial, what's on the record here, in both the motion to dismiss and trial, it's a combination of factors in which the prosecution tried to independently corroborate pieces of, parts of, internal statements that were internal to the confession. Yes, there were benches in the rec center. Yes, he had signed in, even though we don't know whether his daughter was there or not. That's not the issue. It's not the legal issue in corpus delicti. There wasn't any independent evidence that a crime was committed. And so I think that today, what I would urge the court to do is to, as I know you will, stay on that narrow track of Rankin versus going off on the Martinez-Trujillo exception and trying to corroborate the statement internally versus show that a crime has been committed. The other thing that happened in the case law along the way is that largely due to the Court of Appeals jurisprudence and one Supreme Court, I think Meredith dealt with this, but the jurisprudence developed that opportunity evidence is not enough. And so I think there was a question that all of us had. So what does this independent evidence look like? What does it need to look like? We knew that it didn't have to be overwhelming, and I don't contest that at all. And I don't mean to misrepresent it. Slight is enough. That's what the cases say. But what does it look like? Well, we know from TAO and from Robson and from other cases that it has to be more than opportunity evidence, that that's not enough. And so what we have in LaRosa is two things, both of which look pretty good at first glance, logically, but they fall short of the real legal bar. And that is, we have some evidence that corroborates some of the statements internal to the confession. And the second thing we have is we have evidence from, not just from the confession, but we have independent evidence from the rec center, some circumstantial evidence that he was at least there. And so we have some evidence of opportunity. The evidence was in conflict at trial as to whether his daughter and he were ever alone.
Oh, the defendant was a custodial parent. Was he not at the time?
Yes.
He had opportunity all the time.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you don't have to prove opportunity because he had opportunity.
Every night.
That's almost a given.
Every night, every day. Absolutely. And so the fact that he was at the rec center, that he was alone with her, he was like Robson, I suppose, in that regard. It was his daughter. He was alone with her. He had equal custody to her, just like Mr. Robson did. That was opportunity. So that's not enough. The opportunity at the rec center is no different than the opportunity at home. But I guess my point in this case is that there is some evidence independent of the confession, but it only does those two things.
What about the instance where you have here multiple statements, at least two, where he has implicated himself in this kind of conduct? Can they be used to corroborate each other and become corpus delicti?
There were two statements in TAO as well. There were two statements in TAO as well. For example, I think the answer from the case law is no, because TAO, the juvenile, had confessed to his therapist that he had touched his sister, and he also confessed to a detective, and both of those statements came in. And in some of the other cases, there were multiple statements, not just to law enforcement, but to other people as well. So TAO was that self-report from the therapist initially, then made the same statement to the detective. That wasn't enough.
Can I just follow up on that a little bit? Was the trial court here asked to rule on that specific issue? I mean, did the people make that argument in the trial court that the multiple statements by the defendant himself corroborated each other, or is that even in front of us?
That argument was made. I don't think it was made as a dispositive argument. It was certainly made. I think the mistake that was made in the trial court, which won't be made here, was a mistake of saying this statement looks good, it looks valid, it looks and sounds, there's a CD, it looks good, it sounds good. I think that's a mistake that was made in the trial court. If there are no other questions, I'll reserve, if I may, for...
You may.
May I please the court? Paul Kaler, 19210, here for the people in this case. People's view is that the corpus delicti doctrine is very limited because it intrudes into the province of the jury. The jury's exclusive role to determine the facts in a case. The question here is fairly standard, like we have in any sufficiency of the evidence case. Is there evidence from which a rational jury could have found that this was corroborated? And as counsel referenced, four main cases here are Martinez, which speaks about, uses the phrase slight corroborative evidence. Trujillo, which speaks about in cases where there's no tangible injury, which under the facts of this case, there would not be any tangible injury, whether evidence independent of the confession, which would tend to establish its truthfulness, much more like the federal standard that the U.S. Supreme Court uses in Opper, which is the corroborative evidence need not be sufficient independent of the statements to establish the corpus delicti. And also the Quinn case, which the only real outside corroborating evidence was the inmate's reference to the type of alcohol that supposedly had been introduced by the victim or by the defendant. And then Hodges, which had to do with the importation, sufficiency of this importation aggravating factor, which was that the defendant said he had been in California, which is why he said that on the witness stand, while he had, which is where he said in his confessions he did that. The evidence of this kind of case, this particular type of victim and this particular type of act against the victim, in many ways, it could never be corroborated unless the defendant takes photographs of the situation. But I do believe, following this case law, where we need slight corroborative evidence.
Children report these things. Children engage in strange behaviors that eventually are identified as being consistent with having been sexually abused. I mean, it is not like this child lacks any protection at all. She never said anything that happened, and when afforded the opportunity to, still didn't.
I'll hop ahead to that, Your Honor. I think that's more of our corroboration was she confirmed that she had gone to the rec center with her father, which the other witnesses said she had not done. She confirmed that when she would go swimming with her father, he would help her in the shower, which corroborates what happened here.
Her statement was unlawful. She took her own clothes off. She took her own shower.
I thought the evidence was, Your Honor, that she stated that he was there with her, helping her.
Well, I don't think she, on at least one occasion, yes, they took showers together at the rec center. I think that's clear.
And when they started talking, when they started asking her about the events in question here, she clammed up completely, which I...
So she corroborates non-criminal behavior.
Right, and then...
There is no corroboration of criminal behavior.
Right.
And you're saying that's corpus delicti?
Her response to clamming up about, to stopping talking completely about the acts here, I think that is more, that is additional slight corroborative evidence to the defendant's two statements.
How so? I mean, what is, I mean, there's 1,000 inferences you could draw from that.
Well, that's what I'm saying, Your Honor, that when there are multiple inferences that can be made, that is a question for the jury to resolve here. The defendant's theory of defense, of course, was that he made these multiple confessions, not only to the police twice, but to his wife and mother, and apparently his pastor as well, because he was undergoing some sort of mental stress.
Well, it seems a bit Orwellian, frankly, to say that evidence of a failure to accuse is evidence that a crime occurred.
Yeah, if that was all, I think that would be pretty thin, Your Honor. And this is all very thin. People admit that freely, that this is this type of case, you're always going to have very thin corroboration. Unless the defendant...
Not always going to have... I think that's really overstating it. We have a lot of these kinds of cases where you have an accusation by the victim. That's almost always how this arises. We don't have that here. We have the opposite here.
A child with limited communicative skills accusing a parent, I think this is not a unique situation, and certainly there have been other cases like this where children make outcry statements, but here the outcry was made by the defendant multiple times.
One of the things that's curiously missing from this case is expert testimony. Now, had the people put on a witness who said, this is common among, which it seems to me they always do. I mean, there must be 1,000 things common to, even that conflict with each other, common to children who are victims of sexual abuse. It is common for them to delay reporting. It is common for them not to report. It is common for them to not say anything when asked, okay? Particularly when, as here, the mother and the grandmother asked the DA's office to withdraw the case, to not pursue it. They were uncooperative, even obstinate on the stand, indicating that the child was under pressure from them, perhaps. No such testimony is in this record that would fortify the inference you want us, or you want the jury to draw.
Well, certainly they could have done that, Your Honor, but we're getting into whether the prosecution presented an overwhelming case, or at least not, I think in this kind of case it would never be overwhelming.
Oh, that would not make it overwhelming, but it would give a basis for the jury to say the fact that she walked out on the social worker when the discussion turned to this. And by the way, this, if I remember the record, the social worker did not testify. Although promised in the pretrial motion to dismiss, she didn't testify to these events. Somebody who was present, as an investigating officer who was present, I think, testified, and drew no implication from the conduct. Well, the social worker might have been able to do.
Certainly they could have brought in an expert to testify that, but I would think people who've been around 2.5-year-old children, when they talk to them about something, want to talk to them about an issue which the child does not want to talk about, I think that is that the child would walk off and become uncommunicative. I don't think that's something, that's a issue for which expert witness testimony is required. I think that's well within the ken of normal people who you would find on a jury. Certainly it could present evidence on that, but I don't think it's necessary. I don't think it's necessary to meet the corpus delicti, the slight corroborative burden we have for the corpus delicti test, especially in a case here where this is a type of case where there will be no tangible injury.
There's no evidence here of coercion or undue influence on the child by anyone.
No, although certainly the circumstances where the family members got up and were combative about the case and were hostile witnesses.
They were never declared such.
No, that's right. Well,
The child also gave a deposition.
Pardon me, Your Honor?
The child also gave a deposition.
I believe so.
And that was played for the jury. And I've seen it. I don't recall exactly what was said in that deposition, except I don't recall that any direct questions were asked her by anybody about what happened at the sports center or the rec center. They were just sort of general questions about, do you go swimming with your dad? Well, I go swimming with mother, and I go swimming with dad, yes, you know, those kinds of questions. But and one of the things I was intended to ask counsel, the disc that has the statement to the investigating officer, which I understand is on a telephone call, stops, on the needle thing and turntable we have here to listen to things, doesn't play past a point where it appears that the officer is about to ask questions concerning the events at the rec center. Does anybody have a copy of that is complete?
I don't, Your Honor. All I had access to is what you all had.
Well, it stops there. I would just advise you. I've tried several times to listen beyond that, and it stops inexplicably. Stops. I don't think it's my equipment as ancient as it is. Okay, well, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I guess that's really all we have here today. Slight corroborative evidence, and when it's a no tangible injury case, what this court said through here is whether the evidence independent of the confession, which would tend to establish its truthfulness. And here, I think there is more than sufficient evidence that the defendant, in the manner of speaking, the number of people he made it to, and the details that could be corroborated in it, met the slight corroborative evidence standard.
Don't those details, though, have to go to criminal behavior? The only details corroborated here, as I said before, go to non-criminal behavior. Again, it seems like you're trying to prove that something happened by the mere fact that nobody said anything about it. I don't think that's how it works in this country, frankly. I mean, we do have proof beyond a reasonable doubt as the standard here. And we're saying the fact that she didn't say anything means that something happened.
Well, I'll say this. Corpus delicti, the version we follow here in Colorado, is followed in very few jurisdictions.
But we do follow. And this court doesn't have the authority to say we're not going to follow.
Yeah, I admitted that in our answer brief. And that's why most jurisdictions do not follow this version of corpus delicti. But we believe, I don't, let's see. Well, I'll go back to Quinn Hodges again. There was just very slight there. There was very slight corroborative evidence. My reading of Quinn is that they had the relationship, and they had an opportunity. And the only other evidence is the inmate reference to the type of alcohol supposedly that the defendant said she had bought for him and got into prison.
And that went right to the criminal behavior at issue. That corroboration.
But I don't think his letter said that this was in the jail or not. I think it was just a reference. The opinion is not very clear on this point, but it doesn't go into a lot of detail about whether I had a nice maker's mark in my cell today, or I sure do like that maker. I sure like maker's mark. I don't think there's any particular tying of what the inmate said to the defendant that makes it a criminal act. Similarly, in Hodges, the only corroboration there, or the real corroboration there concerning importation, is the defendant said he had been in California. And I think he said on the witness stand, I think he also said he traveled by bus from California to Colorado. Being in California, I don't think, is obviously not a criminal act. But in both of those cases, this court held that that was sufficient corroboration under the facts of those cases to meet our burden of slight corroborative evidence in order to push the rest of the factual determinations.
About slight corroborative evidence instead of corpus delicti. Are you saying corpus delicti does not apply here, and what we should be looking for is slight corroborative evidence?
No, I think that's, in this particular case, I think they're tied up together. I think we, I think we, well, I think maybe you could say that corpus delicti is sort of a subset of normal sufficiency of the evidence, which is directed at where the defendant is convicted based on his confession.
You said that we are now a minority. I looked at the articles. I haven't read them, studied them, the articles you cite. One's from Indiana, one's from California, and the third, I've forgotten the third. None of those states have abandoned the rule of corpus delicti that we have here. Massachusetts may have, if Judge Lerner Hand is correct, but I've read that case, and I'm not sure that Massachusetts has abandoned it. What states are you relying on in saying we are the minority in requiring corpus delicti in confession cases?
Well, I have a research memo that I tasked one of our summer interns to write, and she cited to a large number of cases from other states saying that corpus delicti, the rule of corpus delicti is the same one that, or to the extent that it's followed, as the one that's the U.S. that the U.S. Supreme Court talks about in Smith and Opper, where it goes towards the trustworthiness of the confession and not whether to corroborate in other ways. And Opper and Smith have been, I guess, in effect for, what, 55, 65 years in the federal system.
But I think, as you said, it's crystal clear that's not the rule in Colorado.
Oh, yeah. That was obviously setting up.
You're talking to the wrong court.
I'm doing my usual thing. Trying to be as honest as possible so that I know where I'm going next.
Okay.
I have an idea. I'm sorry, I will entertain any further questions the court might have concerning the case. Oh, out of time.
Thank you, counsel. Much.
Judge Roy, I should address the CD issue. I don't have any more closure on that either. I'm not sure what the logistics of that really were. My reading of it was that there was a subsequent statement when he turned himself in, a face-to-face statement, where those issues were dealt with more completely. But I, too, don't understand the CD issue at all.
Okay.
I just briefly, I think that clearly the court is all over the issues here. In many of these cases, with Hodges being an example, in many of these cases, the corroborating evidence, it gets us off on the wrong track. The independent evidence of a corpus delicti comes from the defendant's own testimony at trial, and Hodges is one of those cases. And what Hodges actually said was that, yes, he was in California, and he was in California, the case suggests, at the time when the informant went out there to actually do the buy. It was pretty strong independent evidence, which actually came from the defendant in his own trial testimony. So in many of those cases, it actually comes from the defendant's testimony at trial. If you look at those cases, in my brief, I talk about the chronology of some of those cases, and I talk about, you know, examples of what's been found to be slight independent evidence. May call it slight. It's pretty significant evidence that's required and that's found in all those cases. It's really significant evidence. And Martinez, Mr. Martinez and his brother were found out here in a liquor store on West Colfax. This is a great case from 1954. He's found out here in a liquor store on West Colfax with a crowbar and a hammer beating into the wall of the liquor store on West Colfax. And his brother, Julio, was over here being a pretty good lookout. And police officers came by and discovered them trying to hack into the wall of this liquor store. And they arrested him, and there was this confession that they had conspired to burglarize the liquor store and steal some liquor. And so the court found that there was independent evidence to corroborate their confession for the conspiracy, because they had actually been found trying to chisel their way through the wall. This slight evidence is pretty strong in most of these cases, if you look at it by comparison. I don't consider myself scholarly enough to talk about the policy of the corpus delicti rule. It's enough for me to know that's the law, and you clearly know that it's the law. All I can say about that is that
This is a terribly sad case, a disturbing case, one in which the family, as they hear me now, are still convinced that it didn't happen. Perhaps this is a case in and of itself that justifies the retention of the corpus delicti rule and sort of reminds us that while it may be troublesome for the prosecution, it really does serve a valid purpose, so that well-meaning, sad, but innocent people are not wrongfully convicted and sent to prison for life. It may be a pretty good rule today. Thank you all.
We thank both counsels for the briefs and arguments. The case will be deemed submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.